Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday. This is the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System about recent developments that impact the public safety workplace. My name is Will Aitchison. I'm going to be your host for the next 45 minutes to an hour or so while we talk over things that have been happening of interest in the last 30 days. And there's been a lot. Probably most importantly, two things that have occurred at the national level from federal agencies. First of all, the Department of Labor has finally released its new regulations on exempt employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act. These are the long-awaited regulations we anticipated. They might be out months and months ago. There's just been silence from the Department of Labor, and nobody has known exactly why. And now that we see the final regulations, we're still not sure why the silence happened. They don't seem to be all that revolutionary. Okay, what's up? What's going on with these regulations? Well, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is a long ago law, was enacted in 1938, first applied to the public sector really in about 1973 by Congress. Fair Labor Standards Act has three broad exemptions from overtime. These are people who still have to be paid the minimum wage, but they're just not entitled to overtime. And the three exemptions are very sparsely described in the FLSA itself. If you're counting, it's section 213A of the FLSA. And they are described as the executive, administrative, and professional exemptions. Congress, when it passed these exemptions, gave virtually carte blanche authority to the Department of Labor to define what those terms meant. And over time, the Department of Labor has said there's a two-part definition for all of those exemptions. The first is what is known in shorthand parlance as the duties test, and the second is known as the salary test. The important thing to remember here is that in order to be exempt, in order to not get overtime, you have to meet both the duties and the salary tests. If you fail either one of them, you're not exempt and you're entitled to overtime without regard to how much you are paid. You could have somebody who makes $1 million a year, and if they don't pass the duties test, they're not exempt. You could have the highest ranking person in a company, and if they don't pass the salary test, they're not exempt. Well, what are the various duties that qualify for these three exemptions? Think of the executive exemption as being somebody basically with hiring and firing authority or the ability to make effective recommendations with respect to hiring and firing. Those are the sorts of people who are typically covered by the executive exemption. These are high-ranking individuals in a police or fire agency. I would expect them in a police agency to have at least the rank of lieutenant, and I would expect them in a fire department to have at least the rank of battalion chief, and maybe even higher, depending upon what their duties might be. Those are executives. Administrative people are, think of them as sort of the confidential secretaries of the world. They're very tight with respect to the organizational structure and the implementation of strategy. They tend to be given a great deal of discretion in the way that they carry out their jobs. They may not have hiring and firing and all of that authority, so they're not going to be executives, but they're going to be integral enough to an employer's operations that they will be exempt as administratives. The third exemption is professionals. That is typically somebody who has to have a specific college degree or other course of higher learning in order to do their job. Professionals are people like, for example, lawyers and doctors, where it's a prolonged course of study in order to enter that particular job. There are very few professionals actually out there in the public safety and in the public sector, and even fewer in the public safety world. So that's the duties test. Are you an executive? Are you an administrator? Or are you a professional? That's not what the Department of Labor's new rules are about. The Department of Labor's new rules deal with the salary test. The salary test requires that you make a minimum amount of money. The theory is it's a salary, and it doesn't vary depending upon how little or how much you work. Theoretically, a salaried employee could show up for 36 hours a week and their pay should not be docked, or they could show up for 44 hours a week and they wouldn't get overtime. The idea is that it's a fixed amount of compensation that is paid for a specific period of time. What the Department of Labor's new rules deal with are the minimum salary thresholds necessary to qualify for the exemption. Now, these salary thresholds haven't been changed in quite a while. They were last changed in 2004, and the salary rules have over time really been particularly subject to political vicissitudes. As you find more conservative presidential administrations, you're going to see little movement or maybe even downward movement in the salary thresholds. As you find more liberal, politically liberal departments of labor and presidential administrations, you're going to see the salary thresholds go up. And so it was when the salary tests were last adjusted in 2004. Then we had the presidential administration of George Bush, the second George Bush. It was very politically conservative. They set the salary threshold at $23,660 per year. And to give you a feel for what that means, you ended up getting court decisions after that that described employees who were making $12 and $13 an hour as highly compensated executives making a salary that qualified them for the exemption under the FLSA. When the Bush administration enacted these regulations, lots of people lost their eligibility for overtime. I've seen a lot of different estimates on it, and as you can imagine, it probably depends a lot on your perspective which of these estimates are accurate. The most common number that I've seen is that about 8 million people lost their eligibility for overtime when the Bush administration enacted these regulations. So one of the things that we all expected when the Obama administration Department of Labor took over is that we were going to see these salary tests adjusted quickly and adjusted upward. Well, we saw them adjusted upward, but we didn't see them adjusted quickly because it took 7 years for the Department of Labor to get around to adjusting these salary thresholds. And that's what the Department of Labor just did in May, with new regulations that will be effective on December 1 of this year. The salary threshold is going to go up to $47,476 a year. That's slightly more than double what it is right now. So it's going to be a huge leap in the salary threshold. The Department of Labor is doing something else with that salary threshold. It's not picking that number out of the air. You might be wondering, how do you get to $47,476 a year? Well, what they did was to say, we're going to peg that salary threshold at the 40th percentile of earnings nationally. The Department of Labor surveys these things for full-time salaried individuals. And the 40th percentile is $47,476. Department of Labor is doing something else that it's never done before with these regulations. It is putting an automatic escalator in the regulations. It is saying every 3 years, we're going to go back, we're going to revisit the salary threshold, and we're going to adjust it for the 40th threshold or 40th percentile. And so you can anticipate that in 2019, we're going to see the salary test be adjusted upwards, provided that is, of course, we continue to have a politically liberal Department of Labor. Now, the Department of Labor's new regulations do something else. Back in 2004, the Department of Labor created basically an entirely new salary test out of whole cloth. It had not been seen before. And it described this new salary test as one for highly compensated employees. And what it did was to relax the duties test if you made above the threshold for a highly compensated employee. It's very, very easy to be exempt if you're a highly compensated employee. So what number did the Department of Labor use in 2004? Well, it picked a really round number totally out of the air, $100,000, right on the nose. So if you made $100,000, you're a highly compensated employee, and it's very easy for you to be considered exempt as an executive, administrative, or professional employee. What the Department of Labor did in May of this year is to adjust that number up to $134,004 a year. You might anticipate that that number was deliberately set, and it was. It's the 90th percentile for earnings for salaried employees, and it too will be adjusted upwards or downwards, if appropriate, every 3 years under the Department of Labor's regulations. That's it. There are some other changes. They're more minor, but that's it with respect to the major changes in these FLSA rules. What we did not see from the Department of Labor were new rules about what I think of as the broad question of what's work. The Department of Labor had signaled that it was going to contemplate new rules, particularly dealing with the off-duty use of technology by employees, particularly focused on smartphones and things like smartphones. The Department of Labor last year said, we really think we're going to start the comment period on new rules to redefine whether or not that time spent with these devices off-duty is work. Which would have meant the Department of Labor would have to re-examine another rule, which is known as the de minimis rule, that small amounts of work are not compensable under the FLSA. But the Department of Labor didn't do any of that and didn't tell us in May of this year why it wasn't addressing those issues. So I think these new rules, at least for public safety employees, are kind of a snooze. I think you're going to have a lot of employees who are going to be impacted by the difference in the salary threshold. They're probably going to be employees in non-union environments, probably largely geographically clustered in the South. I don't think you're going to see too many employees affected by it. You might have seen a lot of employees affected by a change in, or at least an articulation of, off-duty activities with electronics, but the Department of Labor pulled its punch on that one, and we haven't seen it. As you might imagine, we see the more conservative members of Congress starting to go a little bit crazy about these new regulations. They're already promising that they're going to try a legislative fix. Some of them have announced they intend to introduce legislation that will undo the Department of Labor's new salary thresholds. You can imagine that the president will veto that legislation, and that means this whole issue, to the extent it's still a political issue, 12 months from now, is going to fall in the lap of the new president. Now let's go a few blocks away in Washington, D.C. to the headquarters of the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which has released a new document. I'm not even sure what to call this thing. Let's call it a guidance. It doesn't really have an official name. But the EEOC released this thing on May 9th, 2016. We'll post a link to it on our webpage, of course. And here's the EEOC's description of it. It's a document seeking to provide general information to employers and employees regarding when and how leave must be granted for reasons related to an employee's disability. In other words, the EEOC is using this document to describe what the ADA says about leave, or what the EEOC thinks the ADA says about leave. Now, a lot of this document isn't revolutionary at all. It just simply restates what the requirements of the ADA are. And I think it's a good, if you're involved at all in the administration of leave issues, sick leave or vacation time or unpaid leave, I think it's a good document to read just as a basic refresher document. But there are some points I think are worth talking about with respect to this document. The first is that the EEOC has reiterated its somewhat unusual position on employer requirements that employees using sick leave get doctor's notes. Now, there's a lot of litigation out there about doctor's notes, and courts have pretty clearly drawn the lines on this whole doctor's note, EEOC, ADA issue. The ADA, as I've mentioned before in these podcasts, has a privacy provision, a medical privacy provision, and it prohibits employers from getting medical information about employees unless the employers have a reason that is, and I'm quoting from the ADA here, job-related and consistent with business necessity. And courts that have applied that medical privacy provision to doctor's notes have said, look, there's two kinds of doctor's notes. There's a kind that contains diagnostic information. Jenny Jones was absent from work because she had the flu. That contains diagnostic information. And then there's a doctor's note that doesn't contain diagnostic information. Jenny Jones was absent from work for medical reasons and was unable to perform the requirements of her job. Nothing diagnostic in that at all. And courts have said the first type of doctor's note, the one that does have diagnostic information, that's covered by the ADA. And employers have to have reasons that are job-related and consistent with business necessity in order to get that medical diagnostic information. The second type of doctor's note, that's fair game, say courts. Employers can ask for that. It doesn't invade an employee's medical privacy. And so courts have, you know, pretty clearly drawn that line. Now, the EEOC has taken a position that is, I think, very, very curious about doctor's notes. And it has said this for several years. It has said doctor's notes requirements are okay if the employer requires that all employees get them. So, in other words, so long as every single employee using sick leave has to produce a doctor's note, the EEOC's position is it's okay with it. However, the EEOC has never articulated whether or not it is talking about diagnostic or non-diagnostic doctor's notes. And so the position is really, I think, kind of a confusing one. It doesn't tell us the heart of the issue, what type of information is an employer authorized to get under the ADA. And it also takes the position that the employer can only get whatever doctor's notes it can get if it requires these doctor's notes of all employees. And what employer is going to do that? If the employer doesn't want to be inundated with these doctor's notes, nor does it want to burden its health insurance system with the cost of producing these doctor's notes, nor does it want to burden all employees, most of whom it has no reason to suspect of sick leave abuse, with going out and getting these doctor's notes. So the EEOC's position has been, I think, a distinctly unhelpful position. The new guidance that came out on May 9th, 2016, unfortunately perpetuates exactly the same mystery. Here's what the EEOC says, and this is real brief. An employee with a disability, it's giving an example here and a hypothetical. An employee with a disability asks to take 6 days of paid sick leave. The employer has a policy requiring a doctor's note for any sick leave over 3 days that explains why leave is needed, the employee must provide the requested documentation. Well, that's pretty unhelpful, isn't it? It seems to perpetuate the all-employee problem because it says the employer has a policy requiring a doctor's note for any sick leave over 3 days. And it also doesn't articulate whether or not it's a diagnostic or a non-diagnostic doctor's note. So from all of us who are curious about this issue, thank you, EEOC, basically for nothing. Now, the EEOC, though, was clear in other aspects of this document that it released in May. And the first area where it was clear was with respect to maximum leave policies. That's the phrase the EEOC uses to describe caps on the use of leave. And think of these caps really not so much as applying to vacation or sick leave or other paid leave, but more so the maximum amount of time an employee could be off work before the employer starts to the process of terminating the employee. Really, almost all of the time here, we're talking about unpaid leaves of absence. And here, the EEOC has something interesting to say. And once again, I'm going to quote because I think these particular words chosen by the EEOC mean something. The EEOC says, although employers are allowed to have leave policies that establish the maximum amount of leave an employer will provide or permit, they may have to grant leave beyond this amount as a reasonable accommodation to employees who require it because of a disability, unless the employer can show that doing so will cause an undue hardship. In other words, the employer may have to make exceptions to its maximum leave policy. Say, for example, it has a rule that you're only entitled to a unpaid leave of absence of 180 days or a year. The employer may have to make an exception for employees with a disability to reasonably accommodate them. What's an undue hardship? Eventually, you know, if an employee's off work long enough, the employer's going to be able to show an undue hardship. It might have, for example, a specific position number associated with this employee's job that it's unable to fill with a replacement employee. Eventually, that's going to be a hardship, an undue hardship on the employer. But it's not going to be automatic, and it's not necessarily going to be triggered by the passage of X amount of time, 180 days, a year, whatever it might be. So if you're from an employer that has a maximum leave policy, you better be re-examining it. Now, the EEOC also weighs in on what it calls return to work policies under the ADA. And this means, when can an employee come back to work? When can an employee insist that they come back to work? And this is an employee, of course, who has a disability. And here are the EEOC's words on that. Employees on leave for a disability may request reasonable accommodation in order to return to work. The request may be made by the employee or may be made in a doctor's note, releasing the employee to work with certain restrictions. An employer will violate the ADA if it requires an employee with a disability to have no medical restrictions, that is, be 100% healed or recovered. Now, that's problematic, in my experience, for public safety agencies, because many of them take the position that you can't come back to work unless you can do all of the essential functions of the job of being a firefighter or being a law enforcement officer. And here, the EEOC is suggesting that the employer may have to reasonably accommodate somebody. Not permanently, probably, because the EEOC has been clear with other rules that an employer doesn't have to permanently adjust the essential functions of the job in order to accommodate a disability. But it seems clear the EEOC is saying there's going to have to be some sort of ease-in period for employees coming back to work where the employer can't insist on a 100% healthy employee. Well, as I said at the outset of this discussion, if any of this piques your interest, if any of this involves topics that you, for example, as an employer's representative, have to administer, or you in a union may have to deal with through a grievance procedure, go get this document from the EEOC. It's surprisingly in an English language translation. It's pretty, I think, readily understandable, even if you're not used to reading these things for a living. It's worth reviewing. All right, let's move away from Washington, D.C., and let's talk case law, because who wouldn't want to talk case law? Hey, we've got two interesting Garrity cases that came out in the last month, and I want to talk about both of them. I want to start with one that comes out of Alabama. It comes from a federal court of appeals. We don't have too many Garrity cases coming out of a federal court of appeals. And the court gets this decision mostly right, but I think it's a little bit incomplete in its discussion. And that troubles me just a little bit. This case has to do with whether or not reports, written reports, are potentially protected by Garrity. Setting the stage, Garrity versus New Jersey is a long ago Supreme Court decision that says that a public sector employer has the ability to compel employees to give statements that may incriminate them, but the price it pays when it does so, the price it pays under the Fifth Amendment's compulsory self-incrimination clause, the price it pays is that the statements and the fruits of the statements are immunized. And from time to time, we get cases involving written statements rather than questioning. Most Garrity cases involve questioning of employees, either in an internal affairs or other disciplinary investigation. Sometimes Garrity cases come out of use of force situations in law enforcement. But from time to time, we do see written statements. And the general rule has been that Garrity applies to written statements. And I'll get back to that issue in just a moment. But let's get into the facts of this case. And the facts of this case are really, really difficult. I want to warn you in advance. And this may be one of the situations you've heard that truism that hard cases make bad law. This may be one of those examples, at least in this case, a hard case, not a hard case factually, but a difficult case, has made incomplete law. This is a case involving a lieutenant, a corrections lieutenant, who works for the state of Alabama in a facility known as the Ventress Correctional Facility. It's one of these horribly overcrowded facilities. It was built for 650 inmates. It's currently housing over 1,600 prisoners. And this all stems from a series of events that occur in August of 2010. There was an inmate by the name of Rohrkrast Mack who got into a physical altercation with a corrections officer, Melissa Brown. She found him masturbating in his bunk in an area of the correctional facility known as D dorm. And the two got into a fight. And during the fight, they hit each other with their fists. Brown also struck Mack with her baton several times. Mack took the baton away from her. Another corrections officer shows up, tries to intervene. But by that point, Mack had left his cell and had left the lobby of D dorm. Inmates were watching this scuffle. It was really quite a to-do. Brown calls for help on her handheld radio. Smith hears it. He's working. He's the lieutenant. who's in charge that day. Smith ends up kind of doing nothing for just a little bit because he thinks the incident is taking place elsewhere, so he doesn't immediately respond to D-Dorm. Several other officers do, however, and they surround Mac and they begin kicking and punishing him. As they're trying to handcuff him, Mac somehow escapes. One officer thought he heard Smith, the lieutenant, say over the radio. He's listening to all this. Y'all better be beating that motherfucker when I get there, and we're going to kill that motherfucker. When Smith finally does reach Brown, he finds out that she has blood on her mouth and uniform. Some of her fingernails were broken or missing. Her hair was in disarray. And Smith reassures her, don't worry about it. We're going to kill that motherfucker. In the meantime, Mac, remember, he's still kind of grappling with these other corrections officer being kicked and punched by them. He raises his arms over his head, drops to his knees, and he surrenders. As he did so, an officer tackled him and punched him in the head. He then gets handcuffed, and a few of the other officers escort him to Smith's office. While they're waiting for Smith to arrive, some of the officers hit Mac again. He's still handcuffed numerous times in the chest and mouth. And by the time Smith arrives, the other officers removes Mac's handcuffs. When Smith shows up, it gets even worse. He grabs a fiberglass baton from the shift office, goes into his own office. He sees Mac arguing with the officers who were there, and even though Mac wasn't being physically aggressive, Smith beat him with the baton. He ultimately broke the baton with a blow to Mac's head. When an officer tried to pull Smith away from Mac, Mac has fallen to the floor by this point. Smith said, "Do you see my officer down there? She's got blood on her uniform, and the motherfucker's gonna die." Smith then repeatedly stomped on Mac's body, neck, and head. He pepper sprays Mac in the face at close range. Mac doesn't try to fight back. And as you can imagine, eventually Mac dies. He dies from multiple blunt force trauma and traumatic brain injury. Within hours of his attack on Mac, Smith begins to cover up his conduct. He meets with some of the other officers who were involved in the beatings. He tells them to get their story straight and submit statements. He instructs the other officers to document everything and to indicate in their reports that Mac was not handcuffed and that he fought continuously. The department's regulations require Smith to prepare what's known as a duty report and an incident report. He does. And he lies in those reports about the details of the beatings. He claims, for example, falsely that he had to use the pepper spray on Mac and that he only hit him in the thighs and arms in order to stop Mac from fighting. He lies in a lot of different ways. After Mac dies, the FBI comes on the scene. A lot of people are investigated. Smith is federally prosecuted and convicted of civil rights and other violations. He appeals his conviction, and kind of the centerpiece of the appeal is whether or not his written statement, which was introduced against him, his written incident statement and the duty report, whether those statements are protected by Garrity. They were introduced to obtain the conviction of Smith, so they were clearly used under Garrity, and the question is, were they protected? And the Federal Court of Appeals upholds Smith's conviction and says that Garrity does not protect the statements. And here's the court's analysis. The court says, look, Garrity only applies to statements that are given when an employee reasonably believes they are under threat of possible job loss. It doesn't apply just to any speculation on the part of an employee as to whether or not they're compelled to give a statement. They have to reasonably believe that if they don't give a statement, they will be terminated. Incidentally, long line of cases saying that. In fact, going back to Garrity, but a long line of cases that say that. Well, what about these written statements? After all, the department's rules do require that Smith and any other lieutenants give those sorts of statements. Well, here's what the court says, and I'm quoting, "In the absence of a direct threat of termination, we determine whether the officer's statements were compelled by examining his belief and, more importantly, the objective circumstances surrounding it." Smith didn't testify at the evidentiary hearing in the case, and the court found that Smith failed to present any evidence that he subjectively believed he would be terminated if he refused to submit the reports. And the court goes on to say, look, even if Smith had produced this necessary evidence that he believed he would be terminated, Garrity doesn't stand for the proposition that a statement in a standard report is coerced, and I'm quoting from the court's opinion, whenever an officer faces both the remote possibility of criminal prosecution if he files the report and arguably even speculative possibility of termination if he declines to do so. And so the court says, look, a routine report like this, the possibility that the employee could be terminated is too speculative. All right. So what's the problem with this court's opinion? Why am I saying it's incomplete? I don't think the court really understands paramilitary organizations as well as it should. I think had Smith actually testified in this case, he could have testified that, look, the requirement to fill out one of these reports, that's a requirement that's in my department's rules. And if I violate those rules, other provisions of the rule say I'm subject to discipline up to and including termination. I don't think the court understands that that's really the way it works in a paramilitary organization. And I think that's an issue that may have to wait for another day and a more thoughtful analysis by a court. But even if this court is right, that Smith's statement wasn't coerced, does that mean that all statements, all written statements, aren't protected by Garrity? Well, let me hearken back to a decision from a Minnesota state case that was published last year. And it involved an officer who was involved in an automobile accident. I think it was a police officer. It might have been a deputy sheriff, but I think it was a police officer who was specifically ordered face-to-face by his supervisor to write a report. Trial court had no difficulty finding that that was a compelled statement under Garrity. What's the difference between the two? In the Minnesota case, the face-to-face order made very clear that if the report was not submitted, there could be discipline up to and including termination. What Smith should have done, if he really intended to get Garrity protections in this massive cover-up that he was engaged in, is before he wrote those written reports, he should have talked to his captain and said, "Captain, am I ordered to write these reports or be subject to termination?" And the captain's answer would have told us whether or not Garrity applied. If the captain said, "Yeah, fill out those reports or you could be terminated," Garrity, I think even in the case of this court in Alabama, Garrity would say that the report would be immunized. If the captain said, "No, you're not required as a condition of employment to fill out these reports. We think there may be something amiss here, and we don't want to give you immunity before we unravel this situation," then Garrity wouldn't apply to the reports. And that's the kind of standard advice that I've been giving employers and unions for years and years. You can solve the mystery of whether Garrity applies to a oral statement or written reports simply by the employee asking a question as to whether they're compelled as a condition of employment to write that report or give that statement. The answer from the supervisor will determine Garrity protections. Our second Garrity case comes to us courtesy of another federal appeals court. This is federal appeals court month on Garrity cases. This one from, I think, the best federal appeals court in the country. It's the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the area of the country that includes states such as Illinois and Indiana. This is an Indiana case. It involves a police officer who works for the Hobart, Indiana Police Department named Kirk Homoki. At least I think that's how you pronounce his name. And he's under investigation for assorted misconduct that arises out of a traffic stop. As part of the investigation, he's ordered by his department to take a voice stress test. By the way, just on a tangent here, do we see voice stress tests used a lot in these sorts of personnel investigations? Of course, many states have banned them even for police officers in disciplinary investigations. They banned them under similar statutes that apply to polygraphs. There's a lot of debate out there, though, among the professionals as to the relative reliability of polygraphs and voice stress tests. And it turns out, I actually researched this a little bit when I was reading this case because I was curious about it. It turns out that you have a lot of polygraphers saying that voice stress tests are not terribly accurate and that polygraphs are much more accurate. And you find the people who give voice stress tests, go figure, saying exactly the opposite thing. So I think that the answer is probably a giant shrug of the shoulders. Who knows? I don't think anybody professes, or I don't think too many scientists profess to believe that either polygraphs or voice stress tests are particularly accurate, but they can be very useful investigative tools because of the dialogue that goes on in the course of these tests. So back to Officer Homoki in Hobart, Indiana. He's ordered by a letter from a deputy chief to go take this voice stress test. And in the letter, he's told this is part of an administrative investigation. It's not criminal. And you are, and I'm quoting, afforded the protection of the Garrity rule. Homoki receives a document that says advice of rights. It's basically a reverse Garrity warning that promises immunity from his statements and the fruits of his statements in a criminal prosecution. He's off to go see the voice stress test person who happens to be in the local sheriff's office. And preparatory to giving the voice stress test, the expert, let me call him the examiner, the examiner hands Homoki a release form. And the release form says, you are here voluntarily, and you're not going to sue me as a result of these tests. Homoki balks, and he says, hey, I'm not here voluntarily. I was ordered to be here, and I don't think I want to sign this waiver of your potential liability in this situation. A big discussion ensues. It involves eventually Homoki's lawyer, Homoki ends up saying, I'm not going to take the test. The police chief responds by notifying Homoki that he intends to terminate him for insubordination. And at that point, things get a little bit unusual. It appears that there are some local rules that require that disciplinary investigations be conducted under a certain time frame. The department's efforts to terminate Homoki do not comply with those with that time frame, and as a result, the police chief eventually withdraws the notice that he is going to terminate Homoki. What he does is to send Homoki a letter telling him, you need to report for work, you need to dress down, and you're on garage duty. That's a duty in the department that includes, charmingly, scrubbing toilets. The garage duty continued for 2 months when Homoki was ordered to report for modified uniform duties, which included fingerprinting and checking vehicle identification numbers. Homoki has had enough. He sues the city, and it's a Garrity lawsuit. He says the efforts to force me to sign the relief were release by the examiner. That was an attempt to get me to waive my privilege against self-incrimination. And that's the dispute that ends up before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And the court isn't buying it. The court says there's no constitutional violation that happens because Homoki never took the stress test. If he'd taken the test and the results were admitted in a criminal prosecution, then we'd have a Garrity violation. But he never took the test. And under Garrity, as long as the employer promises the employee the requisite degree of immunity from the use of the statements or the fruits of the statements, there's no Garrity violation. The employer can order the employee to answer the questions. So, and let me turn now just very briefly to, I think, a very good summation at the end of the court's opinion of how these Garrity principles apply. In sum, a police department may, I'm going to interject something there, Garrity applies to all public sector agencies, not just police departments. Back to the court. A police department may, without violating the Constitution, compel a police officer to answer incriminating questions and prohibit him from invoking his Fifth Amendment right when it warns the officer that it will not use the information gained in any future criminal prosecution. The practice is unconstitutional only when the department fails to tell the officer that it will not use the information in a subsequent criminal prosecution, a mistake the police department did not make here. In other words, for there to be a Garrity violation, you are going to need the department to compel the employee to answer questions. The employee is going to have to answer the questions, and then there's going to have to be an attempt to use the answers criminally. That didn't exist here. I have a couple more cases that I want to talk to you about, not at any great length, but I think they're important because they have some general rules that stretch all the way across the country. The first one is one we don't think about very much, which is unemployment, whether or not somebody who's fired can get unemployment compensation. And state unemployment compensation laws generally award unemployment benefits to employees who have been fired. There are exceptions to that general proposition. Perhaps the most notable is that employees who are fired for, and this is a term of art, misconduct, are not eligible to get unemployment compensation. That word misconduct is actually a fairly high bar. It sounds like that might be any reason that an employee would be fired, but it's not. It really disqualifies fairly few people from getting unemployment insurance. And there's a case that comes out of North Carolina that illustrates that. This is a case involving Freddie Huff, who was a state trooper. When he hired on, he received a pair of state-issued shoes as part of his trooper uniform. The shoes were uncomfortable, so Huff bought a more expensive pair with his own money and he sold his state-issued shoes on eBay to partially offset the cost of his new shoes. His employer, which is the Department of Public Safety, finds out and fires him for violating agency policy. Let me pause for just a moment. Is that a termination offense? I'm kind of curious about it. There's no mention in the court's opinion about any challenge to the discharge itself. The court's opinion is just about unemployment insurance, but unless those shoes had some, you know, special marking or something like that, that doesn't really sound like a termination offense. But anyway, back to the case. And we are talking about North Carolina, which is there's no unions for state troopers or any other police or fire in North Carolina. After Huff is fired, he applies for unemployment benefits, and he's ultimately denied benefits by the state agency in North Carolina that administers the unemployment laws. And the basis for the denial is that his breach of the employer's conduct code amounted to misconduct. Huff appeals, and it ends up before the North Carolina Court of Appeals. And the court overturns the denial and awards Huff benefits. And here's the court's analysis. It's very succinct, just about 3-4 sentences. I'm going to read it to you, and it gives you the core of the definition of misconduct. Violating a work rule is not willful misconduct if evidence shows the employee's actions were reasonable and were taken with good cause. Good cause is a reason which would be deemed by reasonable men and women valid and not indicative, and here comes an important phrase, of an unwillingness to work. Here, the evidence established that Huff's state-issued shoes were uncomfortable, so he bought a more expensive pair of shoes and sold his state-issued shoes to help defray the cost. At the time he did so, he believed the troopers traded in their shoes at a private surplus shop to obtain different ones. So even if Huff's actions violated a work rule, here comes the definition. Those actions did not rise to the level of a willful or wanton disregard of the employer's interest. And that's it. That's the definition of misconduct. That is what is disqualifying from unemployment benefits. It must be conduct that amounts to a willful or wanton disregard of the employer's interest. Now, some states have slightly different phrasing of their definitions of misconduct, but not much. It's pretty much all the same. It is a very, very high threshold. The last case I want to talk about is actually not a labor case. It's a rule impacting fire and police and their civil liability for actions taken or inaction in the course of their job. And this is it's a case that comes from the Illinois Supreme Court. It's a deeply divided court. There are four justices going one way, although they split 2-2 on their rationale, and three justices going the other way. And it's really actually quite an entertaining opinion to read, even if the result seems unusual, wrong to me. But it's still entertaining to read just simply because of how, in part, vitriolic some of these opinions are. So what's the public duty rule that's involved in this case? This is a rule that exists in virtually all states. I would say all states, but I haven't researched it, so I'll say virtually all states have adopted this rule. And it is that governments and their employees owe no duty of care to members of the public to provide governmental services like fire protection and police. And the rule effectively prohibits lawsuits against public safety agencies for failure to respond or failure to respond in a timely manner. It's a liability rule, a rule of immunity that just simply prohibits lawsuits for failure to respond. Now, this case in Illinois involves a woman, I believe she's 58 years old. She's described as elderly. And I must say, I am at the stage of life where I resent that characterization of somebody being 58 as elderly. This is a woman named Coretta Coleman. She lives in an unincorporated area near Joliet, Illinois. She begins to have trouble breathing, and she calls 911. 911 calls are routed to an agency that's known, or eventually here, they're routed to an agency known as Orland Central Dispatch. The original dispatcher who gets the 911 call in a different agency actually puts Coleman on hold and then transfers the call over to Orland Central Dispatch, where another dispatcher picks up. And the dispatcher who picks up is a fellow named Eric Johnson. Johnson starts asking Coleman some questions, but he doesn't get any response. He hangs up, calls Coleman twice, and gets a busy signal on both occasions. He then puts the call in line for an ambulance dispatch, and 3 minutes later, the East Joliet Fire Protection District sends an ambulance. The EMTs go up to the door of Coleman's home and ring the doorbell. She doesn't answer. They bang on the door, yell fire department. Nobody answers. They try to go in. The doors are locked. They look in the windows of the home. They don't see anybody. The EMTs are approached by some neighbors who say there's a couple that lives at the residence, and the EMTs say there's nothing we can do. We can't make a forced entry without police officers present. A supervisor weighs in and tells the EMTs to leave the scene because, and his words were, there was no patient. There's a whole bunch of phone calls in the minutes that follow this. And eventually another set of EMTs return to the Coleman residence. They knock on the door, no one answers. Finally, Coleman's husband arrives, lets him in the house. They find Coleman unresponsive, and she's pronounced dead at the hospital. She dies of a cardiac arrest brought on by a rapid onset of pulmonary edema. Coleman's husband, Coleman's estate, sues. And at the heart of it is that the EMTs should have done something more. They didn't provide an adequate enough response. Now, if the public duty rule applies to this situation, there's no lawsuit. Coleman's estate, her husband, lose. And what the 4-3 majority of the Illinois Supreme Court says is we are overturning the public duty rule. Now, I'm going to read you somewhat confusing language from the court's opinion as to what the rationale is, and then I'll give you an explanation of what the court really is trying to say. What the court's words were, we conclude that the underlying purposes of the public duty rule are better served by application of conventional tort principles and the immunity protection afforded by statutes than by a rule that precludes a finding of duty on the basis of the defendant's status as a public entity. That was helpful, right? What the court's really saying here is, look, if there's going to be immunity in these sorts of situations, if we're going to have something like the public duty rule, it's got to come from the legislature. We are not going to perpetuate it. We may have created it, but we can end it, and we are going to end it right now. And the legislature has not passed a statute that creates or expands upon or even describes the public duty rule. This sends the three dissenting judges off into a tizzy. And it is what one of them authors is a dissent that is really almost Scalia-like in its attack dog nature. And what the dissenting justices say is, What do you mean we need a statute for the public duty rule? The legislature hasn't passed such a statute precisely because it exists in our case law. That's why we have no immunity created in some sort of exemption in a statute enacted by the legislature. We have sucker punched the legislature here. This is something where the legislature would have acted. I mean, after all, we've had this public duty rule for decades and decades. Why would the legislature think we're about to get rid of it? But get rid of it, the court did by this 4-3 majority. The matter was taken up subsequently in a kind of a hurried session in the Illinois State Legislature. As nearly as I can tell from looking into it through Monsieur Google, it doesn't look like the legislature passed anything, so it still may be pending before the legislature. It's hard to tell whether or not this decision will have legs and apply in other states. I tend to think it won't. I tend to think that this is a rule that is far too ingrained in our jurisprudence across the country. But I'll bet they thought that in Illinois, too, before the Coleman case came down. Interesting. It'll be interesting to watch this. Well, that's it for this month. I thank you for joining me in a slightly longer than usual podcast involving the thrilling world of federal regulations and documents that are called guidance. We hope to see you next month on First Thursday. And as always, come check out our website, LRIS.com. We have a bit of a blog that we post from time to time there. Hope you follow us on Facebook at LRIS Online. And as always, remember to go to iTunes and rate this podcast. I am told it means something. I am told there's some significance to that. And I trust the guy who's telling me. So please do go to iTunes and rate us. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off until next month.